Side 4. Azazel by Isaac Asimov. Beginning with, "He travels the fastest," on page 131. "He travels the fastest." I had just returned from a trip to Williamsburg, Virginia, and my relief at getting back to my beloved typewriter and word processor was mingled with a residue of faint resentment at my having had to go in the first place. George did not consider the fact that he had just ravened his way through the offerings of a fine restaurant at my hard-earned expense an adequate reason for offering me sympathy. He said, after he had dislodged a fiber of steak from between two teeth,
"I do not really understand, old fellow, why you should find fault over the fact that otherwise respectable organizations seem to be willing to pay you thousands of dollars to listen to you talk for an hour. Having heard you speak now and then, I would think it far more likely that you speak without charge and refuse to stop unless they pay you thousands of dollars. Surely the latter is the more likely way of squeezing money out of people. Though I have no wish to hurt your feelings, assuming you have any." "When did you ever hear me speak?" I asked.
"The interstices in your own maunderings allow no one more than 24 words at a time."
"Naturally, I was careful to make my point in just 24 words.
George ignored me, as I was sure he would.
"It shows a particularly unlovely side of your soul," he said, "that in your mad lust for the dross called money, you should so freely and frequently consent to undergo the pains of the travel you claim to hate. It reminds me a bit of the tale of Sophocles Moskowitz, who had a similar lazy disinclination to stir from his armchair, except when the further swelling of his already gross bank account was in view. This disinclination he also euphemized by calling it an aversion to travel. It took my friend Azazel to change that."
"Don't you get your 2-centimeter disaster demon after me," I said in alarm,
an alarm that was just as real as it would have been if I had actual cause to think that that figment of George's diseased imagination really existed.
George again ignored me.
"It was actually," George said, "one of the first times I ever called upon Azazel for help. It was almost 30 years ago, you see. I had only recently learned how to draw the little creature from his own plane, and I had not yet learned to understand his powers. He boasted of them, to be sure, but where is the living creature other than myself who does not consistently overstate his or her own powers and abilities? I was much more familiar at that time with a magnificent young woman named Fifi, who had, a year earlier, decided that Sophocles Moskowitz would not, in person, sufficiently detract from the kind of husband his large fortune would make for her. Even after they married, she remained a surreptitious, though inexplicably virtuous, friend of mine. Despite her virtue, I was always glad to see her, however. Something you will understand when I tell you that her figure was one thing that could not be overstated. In her presence, I always remembered, with austere satisfaction, certain amiable indelicacies in which we had participated in the past. Boom Boom, I said, for I had never gotten out of the habit of using her stage name, given her by the common consent of the awed observers of her interesting act. You are looking well. This I had no hesitation in saying, for so was I. Oh, yeah, she said, in the insouciant manner that always recalled the streets of New York in all their brassy splendor.
Well, I ain't feeling good. I could not believe that for a moment, for if my memory could be trusted, she must have felt very good indeed from early adolescence.
But I said, what is the trouble, my resilient dear?
It's Sophocles, that creep.
Surely you're not annoyed with your husband, Boom Boom. It is impossible for so wealthy a man to be annoying.
That's all you know. What a four-flusher.
Listen, you remember you told me Sophocles was as rich as some guy named Croesus, which is a guy I never heard of? Well, how come you never told me this guy named Croesus must have been a champion tightwad?
Sophocles is a tightwad.
Champion? Can you beat it? What's the use of marrying a rich guy who's a tightwad?
Surely, Boom Boom, you can manage to wheedle a little money out of him by the elusive promise of nocturnal Elysium.
Fifi's forehead crinkled a bit. I'm not sure what that means, but I know you, so don't talk dirty. Besides, I promised him he wouldn't get it, whatever it was you said, if he didn't loosen up. But he would rather squeeze his wallet than me, and if you think of it, that's pretty darned insulting.
The poor thing whimpered softly. I patted her hand in as unbrotherly a fashion as I could manage on short notice. She burst out passionately.
When I married that bum, I thought, well, Fifi, here's where you get to go to Paris and the Riviera and Buenos Aires and Casablanca and like that. Ha! Not a chance.
Don't tell me that hound won't take you to Paris.
He won't go nowhere. He says he don't want to leave Manhattan. He says he don't like it out there. He says he don't like plants and trees and animals and grass and dirt and foreigners and any buildings except New York buildings. I say, how about some nice shopping mall? And he don't like that neither.
Why don't you go without him, Boom Boom?
That would be more fun than with him, you can bet. But with what? That guy's got his pants pocket sewed up with all his credit cards inside. I've got to do all my shopping at Macy's.
Her voice rose to a near shriek.
I didn't marry that bozo to shop at Macy's.
I gazed speculatively at various portions of the damsel and regretted that I could not afford them. Before she married, she was occasionally willing to make a contribution to the cause in an art-for-art's-sake manner. But I had a feeling that her nobler status as a married woman had hardened her professional view of the matter. In those days, you must understand, I was even more vigorous than I am now in my present prime of life. But I was as unacquainted with the coin of the realm then as now. I said, suppose I could talk him into liking to travel.
Oh, boy, I sure wish someone could.
Suppose I could. I suppose you would be grateful. Her eye rested on me reminiscently.
George, she said, the day he tells me he's taking me to Paris, you and I do an Asbury Park number. Remember Asbury Park?
Did I remember that New Jersey coastal resort? Could I forget my aching muscles? Every part of me, almost, was stiff for 2 days afterward. I discussed the matter with Azazel over some beer, a stein for me and a drop for him. He found the hops delightfully stimulating. Cautiously, I said to him, Azazel, can those magical powers of yours really do things that would amaze me? He looked at me with a soused expression.
Just tell me what you want. Just tell me what you want. I'll show you whether I'm old fumble hands or not. I'll show them all.
Once, in a moment of stupefaction over some lemon-scented furniture polish, he found the peel extract mind-expanding, he said. He told me that he had once been insulted in that fashion on his own world. I let him have another drop of beer and said carelessly, I have a friend who does not like to travel. I suppose it would be as nothing for a person as skilled and advanced as yourself to change that dislike into an absolute fever to travel. I must admit some of his eagerness vanished at once.
What I meant,
he said in his whistling voice and odd accent,
was for you to ask something sensible, like making that ugly picture on the wall hang straight by the power of my mind alone.
The picture moved as he spoke and hung crookedly in the other direction. Yes, but why should I want my picture straightened? I said. I go to great trouble to get them to hang at a precisely correct non-rectilinear angle. What I do want is to have you imbue Sophocles Moskowitz with a travel mania, one that would lead him to travel, if necessary, even without his wife. I added that because it occurred to me that there might be advantages to having Fifi in town on occasion, with Sophocles out of town. Azazel said,
"That is not easy. An ingrained dislike for travel may well depend on various brain-deforming childhood experiences. It would require mental engineering of the most advanced sort to make up for that. I don't say it can't be done, since the crude minds of your people are not easily damaged, but I would have to have the person pointed out to me, so that I could identify his mind and study it."
That was easy enough. I had Fifi invite me to dinner as an old college classmate. She had spent some time on a college campus a few years back, though I don't think she attended classes. She was very extracurricular. I brought Azazel with me in my jacket pocket and could occasionally hear him squeaking elaborate mathematical formulas under his breath. I assumed he was analyzing Sophocles Moskowitz's mind, and if so, that was an impressive feat, for it did not take much conversation for me to appreciate the fact that his mind was not large enough to allow much scope for analysis. Once home, I said to Azazel, "Well?" With an airy wave of his scaly little arm, he said,
"I can do it. Do you have a multi-phase mentodynamic synaptometer handy?"
"Not handy," I said. "I lent mine out yesterday to a friend of mine who was leaving for Australia."
"That was stupid of you," grumbled Azazel. "That means I'll have to work by tablecloth calculations."
He remained querulous, too, even after he had finished, as he maintained, successfully.
"It was almost impossible," he said. "Only a person of my own magnificent attainments could have done it, and I had to pin down his mind into its present adjusted form with huge spikes."
I took it he was speaking metaphorically and said so, to which Azazel replied,
"Well, it might as well be huge spikes. No one will be able to budge his mind after this. He's just going to want to travel with such overwhelming firmness that he could almost shake the universe if that was what would be required to make the travel possible. That will show those..."
He burst out into a long string of strident syllables in his native language. I didn't understand what he said, of course, but it was quite clear from the fact that the ice cubes in the refrigerator in the next room had all melted that what he said was uncomplimentary. I suspected he was casting some animadversions on those on his native world who had accused him of lack of deftness. It was not more than 3 days later that Fifi phoned me. She is not as effective on the phone as in person, for reasons that are quite obvious, although perhaps not to you with your congenital inability to take note of the finer things of life. One is more aware of the slight hardness in her voice, you see, when one is not able to be directly reminded of a counterbalancing softness elsewhere.
"George," she cackled, "you must be magic. I don't know what you did at that dinner, but it worked. Sophocles is going to take me to Paris. It's his own idea, and he's awful excited about it. Ain't that great?"
"It's more than great," I said with natural enthusiasm. "It is earth-shaking. We can now indulge in that little promise you made. We can do a repeat of Asbury Park and shake the earth. Women, however, as even you may have noticed from time to time, lack the feeling that a bargain is sacred. They are quite different from men in this respect. They seem to have no conception of the importance of keeping their word, no feeling for honor." She said,
"We're leaving tomorrow, George, so I ain't got time right now. I'll call you when I get back."
She hung up, and that was that. The woman had 24 hours to spare, and I would scarcely have used half of them. But off she went. I did hear from her when she returned, but that was 6 months later. She phoned me again, and at first I didn't recognize her voice. There was something haggard and worn out about it. "To whom am I speaking?" I asked with my usual dignity. She said wearily,
This is Fifi Laverne Moskowitz.
Boom Boom, I cried. You're back. Marvelous. Come on over right now and let's... She said, George, drop dead. If it's your magic, you're a miserable phony, and I wouldn't Asbury Park with you if you could hang by your toes twice as long. I was astonished. Didn't Sophocles take you to Paris?
Yes, he did. Now ask me, did I get my shopping done?
I was willing. Did you get your shopping done?
Like fun. I didn't even get it begun. Sophocles never stopped.
Her voice shed its weariness, and under the stress of emotion, rose to a shriek.
We reached Paris and kept right on going. He kept pointing out things as we passed at top speed. That's the Eiffel Tower, he said, pointing to some stupid building under construction. That's Notre Dame, he said. He didn't even know what he was talking about. Two football players once smuggled me into Notre Dame, and it ain't in Paris. It's in South Bend, Indiana. But who cares? We went on to Frankfurt and Bern and Vienna, which them stupid foreigners call Wien. Is there some place called Trieste?
Trieste, I said. Yes, there is.
Then we went there, too. And we never stopped off at hotels. We stopped at old farmhouses. Sophocles said that was the way to travel. He said you saw the people and nature. Who wants to see people and nature? What we didn't see was showers and plumbing. After a while, you get so you smell. And I got things in my hair. I just now took 5 showers, and I'm still not clean.
Take 5 more showers in my place, I urged in the most reasonable possible way, and we can Asbury Park it. She didn't seem to hear me. It's amazing how deaf women are to simple reason. She said,
He's getting started again next week. He said he wants to cross the Pacific and go to Hong Kong. He's going on an oil freighter. He says that's the way to see the ocean. I said, Listen, you screwball creep, you ain't going to get me on no slow boat to China so I can be all to yourself alone.
Very poetic, I said.
And you know what he said? He said, Very well, my dear, I'll go without you.
Then he said something real weird because it made no sense.
He said, Down to Gehenna or up to the throne, he travels the fastest who travels alone.
What does that mean? What's Gehenna? How did a throne get into it? Does he think he's Queen of England? It's Kipling, I said.
Don't be crazy. I never kippled, so don't tell me he did. He can hardly do it missionary. I told him I'd divorce him and take him to the cleaners. And he said, Suit yourself, my submaronic dear, but you have no grounds and will get nothing. All that is important to me is travel. Can you beat that? And that submaronic bit. Still trying to sweet-talk me.
You've got to understand, old fellow, that this was one of Azazel's first jobs for me, and he hadn't learned control. And I had asked him to have Sophocles travel without his wife on occasion. There was still the advantage to such a situation that I had foreseen from the start. Boom Boom, I said, let's talk over the divorce together between Asbury
and you, you miserable wimp. Whatever magic or whatever you did, I don't care. Just stay out of my life, because I know a guy who will squash you into pancakes as soon as I give him the word. And he kipples, too, because he does everything else.
Boom Boom, I'm afraid, had gone bust-bust, though not in a way I would have wanted her to, or, knowing her measurements and style, expected her to. I called on Azazel, but, though he tried, there was no way he could undo what he had done, and he flatly refused to try anything toward making Boom Boom more reasonable toward me. He said that would be too much for anyone. I don't know why. He kept track of Sophocles for me, however. The man's mania grew. He crossed the Continental Divide on his hands. He went up the Nile on water skis all the way to Lake Victoria. He crossed Antarctica on a hang glider. When President Kennedy announced in 1961 that we would reach the moon by the end of the decade, Azazel said,
That's my adjustment doing its work again.
I said, "You mean that whatever you did to his brain gives him the power to influence the president and the space program?"
"He doesn't do it on purpose," said Azazel. "But I told you the adjustment was strong enough to shake the universe."
"And he did go on to the moon, old chap. Remember Apollo 13 that was supposedly wrecked in space on the way to the moon in 1970, with the crew just barely getting back to Earth? Actually, Sophocles had stowed away on it and had taken a portion of it to the moon, leaving the actual crew to get back to Earth as best they could with the rest. He's been on the moon ever since, traveling all over its surface. He has no air, no food, no water, but his adjustment to continual travel must somehow take care of that. In fact, something may have worked out by now to take him to Mars and elsewhere." George shook his head sadly. "So ironic. So ironic." "What's ironic?" I asked. "Don't you see? Poor Sophocles Moskowitz. He is a new and improved version of the Wandering Jew, and the irony is that he isn't even orthodox." George put his left hand to his eyes and fumbled for his napkin with his right hand. In doing so, he accidentally picked up the $10 bill I had placed at the side of the table as a tip for the waiter. He mopped his eyes with his napkin, but I didn't see what happened to the $10 bill. He left the restaurant sobbing and the table bare. I sighed and put out another $10 bill. The Eye of the Beholder. George and I were sitting on a bench at the boardwalk and contemplating the broad expanse of the beach and the sparkling sea in the distance. I was immersed in the innocent pleasure of watching the young ladies in their bikinis and wondering what they could get out of the beauties of life that was half as much as they contributed. Knowing George as I did, I rather suspected his own thoughts to be considerably less nobly aesthetic than mine. I was certain that they would deal with the more useful aspects of those same young ladies. It was with considerable surprise, then, that I heard him say, "Old man, here we sit drinking in the beauties of nature in the shape of the female form divine, to coin a phrase, and yet surely true beauty is not, and cannot be, so evident. True beauty, after all, is so precious that it must be hidden from the eyes of trivial observers. Have you ever thought that?" "No," I said. "I've never thought that, and now that you mention it, I still don't. What's more, I don't think that you have ever thought that." George sighed. "Talking with you, old chap, is like swimming in molasses. Very little return for very great effort. I have watched you observing that tall goddess there, the one whose wisps of fine textile do nothing to conceal the few square inches they purport to cover. Surely you understand that those are mere superficialities that she displays." "I have never asked for much out of life," I said in my humble way. "I'll be satisfied with superficialities of that sort." "Think how much more beautiful a young woman would be, even a woman quite unprepossessing to the untutored eyes of one such as you, if she possessed the eternal glories of goodness, unselfishness, cheerfulness, uncomplaining industry, and concern for others. All the virtues, in short, that shed gold and grace on a woman." "What I'm thinking, George," I said, "is that you must be drunk. What on earth can you possibly know about virtues such as those?" "I am totally familiar with them," said George haughtily, "because I practice them assiduously and to the full." "Undoubtedly," I said, "only in the privacy of your own room and in the dark." "Disregarding your crude remark," George said, "I must explain that even if I did not have personal knowledge of these virtues, I would have learned of them through my acquaintance with a young woman named Melisande Ott, nay, Melisande Wren, and known to her loving husband Octavius Ott as Maggie. She was known to me as Maggie also, for she was the daughter of a dear friend of mine, now, alas, deceased, and she always considered me her Uncle George. I must admit that there is a bit of me that, like you, appreciates the subtle qualities of what you call superficialities. Yes, old boy, I know I use the term first, but we will not get anywhere if you are going to interrupt me constantly over trivialities. Because of this small weakness in myself, I must also admit that when, in an access of joy at seeing me, she would squeal and throw her arms about me, my delight at the event was not quite as great as it would have been had she been more generously proportioned. She was quite thin, and her bones were painfully prominent. Her nose was large, her chin weak, her hair rather lank and straight and pure mouse in color, and her eyes an undefinable gray-green. Her cheekbones were broad, so that she rather resembled a chipmunk that had just completed a fine collection of nuts and seeds. In short, she was not the type of young woman whose arrival on the scene would cause any young man present to begin breathing rapidly and striving to get closer. But she had a good heart. She bore up with a wistful smile at the visible winces that shook the average young man who met her for the first time without warning. She served as bridesmaid for all her friends in turn with a fresh group of wistful smiles. She served as godmother to innumerable children and as babysitter to others, and was as deft a bottle feeder as you could see in a long month of Sundays. She brought hot soup to the deserving poor and to the undeserving as well, though there were some who said that it was the undeserving who more nearly deserved the visitation. She performed various duties at the local church several times over, once for herself, and once each for those of her friends who preferred the guilty splendors of the movie palaces to selfless service. She taught classes at Sunday school, keeping the children cheerful by making, as they thought, funny faces at them. She also frequently led them all in a reading of the Nine Commandments. She left out the one about adultery, for experience had taught her that this invariably led to inconvenient questions. She also served as a volunteer at the local branch of the public library. Naturally, she lost all hope of getting married somewhere about the age of 4. Even the chance of having a casual date with a member of the opposite sex seemed to her to be a rather impossible dream by the time she had reached the age of 10. Many a time she would say to me, "I am not unhappy, Uncle George. The world of men is sealed to me, yes, always excepting your dear self and the memory of poor Papa. But there is far more true happiness in doing good." She would then visit the prisoners in the county jail in order to plead for repentance and for conversion to good works. It was only one or two of the crasser sort who volunteered for solitary confinement on those days on which she was due to arrive. But then she met Octavius Ott, a newcomer to the neighborhood, a young electrical engineer with a responsible position at the power company. He was a worthy young man, grave, industrious, persevering, courageous, honest, and reverent. But he was not what you or I would call handsome. In fact, not to put too fine a point on it, he was not what anyone in recorded history would have called handsome. He had a receding hairline, or more accurately, a receded one, a bulbous forehead, a snub nose, thin lips, ears that stood well away from his head, and a prominent Adam's apple that was never entirely still. What there was of his hair was rather rust-colored, and he had an irregular sprinkling of freckles on his face and arms. I happened to be with Maggie when she and Octavius met in the street for the first time. Both were equally unprepared, and both started like a pair of skittish horses suddenly confronted by a dozen clowns in a dozen fright wigs who were blowing a dozen whistles. For a moment, I expected both Maggie and Octavius to rear and whinny. The moment passed, however, and each successfully weathered the flash of panic they had experienced. She did nothing more than place her hand on her heart, as though to keep it from leaping out of the rib cage in search of a more secure hiding place, while he wiped his brow as though to erase a horrid memory. I had met Octavia some days before, and so I was able to introduce them to each other. Each held out a tentative hand, as though not anxious to add the sense of touch to that of vision. Later that afternoon, Maggie broke a long silence and said to me, "What an odd young man that Mr. Ott seems to be." I said, with that originality of metaphor which my friends all enjoy, "You mustn't judge a book by its cover, my dear." "But the cover exists, Uncle George," she said earnestly, "and we must take that into account. I dare say that the average young woman, frivolous and unfeeling, would have little to do with Mr. Ott. It would be a deed of kindness, therefore, to show him that not all young women are totally heedless, but that one at least does not turn against a young man for nothing more than his unfortunate resemblance to... she paused as no comparable member of the animal kingdom occurred to her, so that she had to end lamely but warmly with, "Whatever it is that he resembles, I must be kind to him." I do not know whether Octavius had a confidant to whom he could unburden himself in similar fashion. Probably not, for few of us, if any, are blessed with Uncle George's. Nevertheless, I'm quite certain, judging from later events, that precisely the same thoughts occurred to him. In reverse, of course. In any case, each labored to be kind to the other, tentatively and hesitantly at first, then warmly, and at last passionately. What began as casual encounters at the library became visits to the zoo, then an evening at the movies, then dances, until what finally took place could only be described, if you'll excuse my language, as trysts. People began to expect to see one whenever they saw the other, for they had become an indissoluble pair. Some of those in the neighborhood complained bitterly that to get a double dose of Octavius and Maggie was more than the human eye could be expected to endure, and more than one supercilious elitist invested in sunglasses. I will not say that I was totally lacking in sympathy for these extreme views, but others, more tolerant and perhaps more reasonable, pointed out that the features on one were, by some peculiar chance, quite opposite to the corresponding features of the other. Seeing the two together tended to introduce a canceling effect, so that both together were more endurable than either separately. Or, at least, that was what some claimed. Finally, there came a day when Maggie burst in on me and said, "Uncle George, Octavius is the light and life of my existence. He is staunch, strong, steady, sturdy, and stable. He is a lovely man." "Internally, my dear," I said, "I'm sure he is all of these things. His outward appearance, however, is adorable," she said, staunchly, strongly, steadily, sturdily, and stably. "Uncle George, he feels about me as I feel about him, and we are going to be married." "You and Otto?" I said faintly. An involuntary image of the likely issue of such a marriage swam before my eyes, and I turned rather faint. "Yes," she said. "He has told me that I am the sun of his delight and the moon of his joy. Then he added that I was all the stars of his happiness. He is a very poetic man." "So it seems," I said dubiously. "When are you going to be married?" "As soon as possible," she said. There was nothing to do but grit my teeth. The announcement was made, the preparations were carried through, the marriage was performed with myself giving away the bride. Everyone in the neighborhood attended out of disbelief. Even the minister allowed a reverent look of astonishment to cross his face. Nor did anyone seem to gaze gladly at the young couple. All through the ceremony, the audience stared at its various knees, except the minister. He kept his eyes firmly fixed on the rose window over the front door. I left the neighborhood some time after, took up lodgings in another part of the city, and rather lost touch with Maggie. 11 years later, however, I had occasion to return over a matter of an investment in a friend's learned studies of the racing qualities of horses. I seized the opportunity of visiting Maggie, who was, among her other well-hidden beauties, a marvelous cook. I arrived at lunchtime. Octavius was away at work, but that didn't matter. I am not a selfish man, and I gladly ate his portion in addition to mine. I could not help but notice, however, that there was a shade of grief on Maggie's face. I said over the coffee, "Are you unhappy, Maggie? Is your marriage not going well?" "Oh, no, Uncle George," she said vehemently. "Our marriage was made in heaven. Although we remain childless, we are so wrapped up in each other that we are barely aware of the loss. We live in a sea of perpetual bliss and have nothing more to ask of the universe." "I see," I said, my teeth rather on edge. "Then why this shade of grief I seem to detect in you?" She hesitated and then burst out, "Oh, Uncle George, you are such a sensitive man. There is one thing that does interpose a bit of grit in the wheels of delight."
"And that is?"
"My appearance."
"Your appearance? What is wrong?"
I swallowed and found myself unable to finish the sentence. "I am not beautiful," said Maggie, with the air of one imparting a well-hidden secret. "Ah," I said. "And I wish I were, for Octavius's sake. I want to be lovely just for him."
"Does he complain about your appearance?"
I asked cautiously.
"Octavius? Certainly not. He bears his suffering in noble silence."
"Then how do you know he is suffering?"
"My woman's heart tells me so."
"But, Maggie, Octavius is himself, well, not beautiful."
"How can you say that?" said Maggie indignantly. "He's gorgeous."
"But perhaps he thinks you're gorgeous."
"Oh, no," said Maggie. "How could he think that?"
"Well, is he interested in other women?"
"Uncle George," said Maggie, shocked. "What a base thought. I'm surprised at you. Octavius has no eyes for anyone but me."
"Then what does it matter if you are beautiful or not?"
"It's for him," she said. "Oh, Uncle George, I want to be beautiful for him."
And leaping into my lap in a most unexpected and unpleasant way, she moistened the lapel of my jacket with her tears. In fact, it was wringing wet before she was quite through. I had by then, of course, met Azazel, the 2-centimeter demon I may have mentioned to you on a Now, old man, there is no need for you to mutter ad nauseam in that supercilious manner. Anyone who writes as you do should be embarrassed at bringing up the thought of nausea in any connection whatever. In any case, I called up Azazel. Azazel was asleep when he arrived. He had a bag of some green material covering his tiny head, and only the muffled sound of quick soprano squeaking from within gave evidence that he was alive. That, and the fact that every once in a while his little sinewy tail stiffened and vibrated with a tinny hum. I waited several minutes for him to wake up naturally, and when that did not happen, I gently removed his head bag with a pair of tweezers. His eyes opened slowly and focused on me, whereupon he gave an exaggerated start. He said,
"For a moment I thought I was merely having a nightmare. I didn't count on you."
I ignored his childish petulance and said, "I have a task for you to do for me."
"Naturally," said Azazel sourly. "You don't suppose I am expecting you to offer to do a task for me?"
"I would in a moment," I said suavely, "if my inferior abilities were sufficient to do anything a personage of your stature and power would find of significant use."
"True, true," said Azazel, mollified.
It is truly disgusting, I might add, the susceptibility of some minds to flattery. I've seen you, for instance, go out of your mind with fatuous joy when someone asks you for an autograph. But back to my tale.
"What is involved?" asked Azazel.
"I wish you to make a young woman beautiful." Azazel shuddered.
"I'm not sure I could bring myself to do that. The standards of beauty among your bloated and miserable species of life are atrocious."
"But they are ours. I will tell you what to do."
"You will tell me what to do?"
he shrieked, vibrating with outrage.
"You will tell me how to stimulate and modify hair follicles, how to strengthen muscles, how to grow or dissolve bone? Indeed, you will tell me all this?"
"Not at all," I said humbly. "The details of the mechanism that such a deed would require are only to be handled by a being of your magnificent attainments. Allow me, however, to tell you the superficial effects to be achieved." Azazel was once again mollified, and we went over the matter in detail. "Remember," I said, "the effects are to be brought to fruition over a period of at least 60 days. A too sudden change might excite remark."
"Do you mean," said Azazel, "I'm to spend 60 of your days supervising and adjusting and correcting? Is my time worth nothing, in your opinion?"
"Ah, but you could then write this up for one of your world's biological journals. It is not a task that many on your world would have the ability or patience to undertake. You will be greatly admired as a result." Azazel nodded thoughtfully.
"I scorn cheap adulation, of course," he said. "But I suppose I have a duty to hold myself up as a role model for inferior members of my species."
He sighed with a shrill whistling sound.
"It is troublesome and embarrassing, but it is my duty."
I had a duty as well. I felt I ought to remain in the neighborhood during the interval of change. My horse-racing friend put me up, in return for my expertise and advice on the results of various experimental runnings, with the result that he lost very little money. Each day I sought an excuse to see Maggie, and the results slowly began to show. Her hair grew fuller-bodied and developed a graceful wave. Red-gold glints began to appear, lending it a welcome richness. Little by little, her jawbone grew more prominent, her cheekbones more delicate and higher. Her eyes developed a definite blue that deepened from day to day to what was almost violet. The eyelids developed just the tiniest oriental slant. Her ears grew more shapely, and lobes appeared. Her figure rounded and grew almost opulent, bit by bit, and her waist narrowed. People were puzzled. I heard them myself. "Maggie," they would say, "what have you done to yourself? Your hair looks simply marvelous. You look 10 years younger." "I haven't done anything," Maggie would say. She was as puzzled as all the others were. Except me, of course. She said to me, "Do you notice any change in me, Uncle George?" I said, "You look delightful, but you have always looked delightful to me, Maggie." "Maybe so," she said, "but I have never looked delightful to me until recently. I don't understand it. Yesterday a bold young man turned to look at me. They always used to hurry by, shading their eyes. This one winked at me, however. It caught me so by surprise I actually smiled at him." A few weeks later I met her husband, Octavius, at a restaurant where I was studying the menu in the window. Since he was about to enter it to order a meal, it was the work of a moment for him to invite me to join him, and the work of half another moment for me to accept. "You look unhappy, Octavius," I said.
"I am unhappy," he said. "I don't know what's got into Maggie lately. She seems so distracted that she doesn't notice me half the time. She wants to be constantly socializing, and yesterday..."
A look of such woebegone misery suffused his face that almost anyone would have been ashamed of laughing at it. "Yesterday," I said. "What of yesterday?"
"Yesterday she asked me to call her Melisande. I can't call Maggie a ridiculous name like Melisande."
"Why not? It's her baptismal name."
"But she's my Maggie. Melisande is some stranger."
"Well, she has changed a bit," I said. "Haven't you noticed that she looks more beautiful these days?"
"Yes,"
said Octavius, biting off the word.
"Isn't that a good thing?" "No,"
he said, more sharply still.
"I want my plain, funny-looking Maggie. This new Melisande is always fixing her hair and putting on different shades of eyeshadow and trying on new clothes and bigger bras and hardly ever talking to me."
The lunch ended in a dejected silence on his part. I thought I had better see Maggie and have a good talk with her. "Maggie," I said.
"Please call me Melisande," she said.
"Melisande," I said. "It seems to me that Octavius is unhappy."
"Well, so am I," she said tartly.
"Octavius is getting to be such a bore. He won't go out. He won't have fun. He objects to my clothes, my makeup. Who on earth does he think he is?"
"You used to think he was a king among men."
"The more fool I. He's just an ugly little fellow I'm embarrassed to be seen with."
"You wanted to be beautiful just for him."
"What do you mean, wanted to be beautiful? I am beautiful. I was always beautiful. It was just a matter of developing a good hairstyle and knowing how to fix my makeup just right. I can't let Octavia stand in my way."
And she didn't. Half a year later, she and Octavius were divorced, and in another half year, Maggie, or Melisande, was married again to a man of superficial good looks and unworthy character. I once dined with him, and he hesitated so long at picking up the check, I was afraid I might have to pick it up myself. I saw Octavius about a year after his divorce. He, of course, had not remarried, for he was as odd-looking as ever, and milk still curdled in his presence. We were sitting in his apartment, which was filled with photos of Maggie, the old Maggie, each one more atrocious than the next. "You must still be missing her, Octavius," I said.
"Dreadfully," he replied. "I can only hope she is happy."
"I understand she isn't," I said. "She may come back to you." Sadly, he shook his head.
"Maggie can never come back to me. A woman named Melisande may wish to come back, but I couldn't accept her if she did. She isn't Maggie, my lovely Maggie."
"Melisande," I said, "is more beautiful than Maggie." He stared at me for a long time.
"In whose eyes?" he said. "Certainly not in mine."
It was the last time I saw either of them. I sat for a moment in silence. Then I said, "You amaze me, George. I was actually touched." It was a poor choice of words. George said, "That reminds me, old fellow, could I touch you for $5 for about a week? 10 days, tops."
I reached for a $5 bill, hesitated, then said, "Here, the story is worth it. It's a gift. It's yours."
"Why not? All loans to George are gifts, de facto."
George took the bill without comment and put it in his well-worn wallet. It must have been well-worn when he bought it, for he never uses it.
He said, "To get back to the subject, could I touch you for $5 for about a week? 10 days, tops."
I said, "But you have $5.
"That is my money," said George, "and no business of yours."
"Do I comment on the state of your finances when you borrow money from me?"
"But I have never..." I began, then sighed, and handed over $5 more. More things in heaven and earth. George had been unusually quiet during dinner, and had not even bothered to stop me when I took the trouble to tell him a few of the many bon mots I had committed in the course of the last few days. A light sneer at my best mot was all I got out of him. Then, over dessert, hot blueberry pie a la mode, he heaved a sigh from the bottom of his abdomen, giving me a not entirely welcome reprise of the shrimp scampi he had eaten earlier in the meal.
"What is it, George?" I asked.
"Something seems to be on your mind."
"You amaze me," said George, "by showing this unwanted sensitivity. Usually you are far too wrapped up in your own miserable writing chores to note another's sufferings."
"Yes, but as long as I've noted it," I said, "let's not waste the effort it has cost me."
"I was merely thinking of an old friend of mine. Poor fellow. Vissarion Johnson, his name was. I suppose you never heard of him?"
"As it happens," I said, "I never did."
"Well, such is fame. Although I suppose it is no disgrace to remain unknown to a person of your limited vision. As it happens, Vissarion was a great economist."
"Surely you jest," I said. "How did you become acquainted with an economist? It sounds like an unusual degree of slumming, even for you."
"Slumming? Vissarion Johnson was a man of great learning."
"I don't doubt that for a moment," I said. "It's the integrity of the entire profession I wonder about. There is the story about President Reagan, who had grown worried about the federal budget, and in trying to work it out, said to a physicist, 'What is 2 and 2? The physicist replied at once, 4, Mr. President. Reagan considered this a moment, making use of his fingers, and found himself dissatisfied. He therefore asked a statistician, 'What is 2 and 2? The statistician replied, after some thought, 'The latest poll among fourth graders, Mr. President, reveals a set of answers that averages fairly close to 4. But it was the budget that was under question, so Reagan felt he should carry the question to the top. He asked an economist, therefore, 'What is 2 and 2? The economist pulled down the shades, looked quickly from side to side, then whispered, "What would you like the answer to be, Mr. President?" George did not by word or facial expression indicate any amusement at this. He said, "You clearly know nothing at all about economics, old fellow."
"Neither do economists, George," I said.
So let me tell you the sad tale of my good friend, the economist Vissarion Johnson. It happened some years ago. Vissarion Johnson, as I told you, said George, was an economist who was at or near the top of his profession. He had studied at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he had learned how to write equations of the most abstruse kind, without as much as a tremble of the chalk. Upon graduation, he entered into practice at once, and thanks to the funds made available to him by a number of clients, learned a great deal about the importance of chance vicissitudes on the daily drift of the stock market. Such was his skill that a few of his clients scarcely lost anything at all. On a number of occasions, he was daring enough to predict that on the morrow the stock market would go either up or down, depending on whether the atmosphere was favorable or unfavorable, respectively, and in each case the market did exactly as he had predicted. Naturally, triumphs such as these made him famous as the Jackal of Wall Street, and his advice was sought after by many of the most famous practitioners of the art of making a fast buck. But he had his eyes fixed on something greater than the stock market, something greater than business machinations, something greater even than the ability to foretell the future. What he wanted was nothing less than the rank of Chief Economist of the United States, or, as this functionary is more familiarly known, Economic Advisor to the President. You, with your limited interests, can scarcely be expected to know the extremely delicate position of Chief Economist. The President of the United States must make the decisions that determine governmental regulations of trade and of business. He must control the money supply and the banks. He must suggest or veto measures that will affect agriculture, commerce, and industry. He must decide the divisions of the tax dollar, determining how much of it goes for the military and whether anything is accidentally left over for anything else. And in all these things, he turns first and foremost to the chief economist for advice. And when the president turns to him, the chief economist must be able to decide instantly and exactly what it is the president wants to hear, and must give it to him, together with the necessary meaningless catchphrases which the president can then, in turn, present to the American public. When you told me the tale of the president, the physicist, the statistician, and the economist, old fellow, I thought for a moment that you understood the delicate nature of the economist's task. But your entirely inappropriate cackle of laughter afterward showed me plainly that you had missed the point altogether. By the time Vissarion was 40, he had achieved all the qualifications needed for any post, however high. It was widely bruited through the halls of the Institute of Governmental Economics that Vissarion Johnson had not once in the last 7 years told anyone anything he or she did not want to hear. What's more, he had been voted into the small circle of the CDR by acclamation. You, in your inexperience of anything beyond your typewriter, have probably never heard of the CDR, which is the acronym for the Club of Diminishing Returns. In fact, very few people have. Even many among the lower ranks of economists do not know of it. It is the small and exclusive band of economists who have thoroughly mastered the intricate realm of pharmaturgical economics, or, as one politician once called it, in his quaintly rustic way, voodoo economics. It was well known that no one outside the CDR could make his mark in the federal government, but that anyone inside it might. Thus, when the chairman of the CDR died rather unexpectedly, and a committee of the organization met with Vissarion to offer him the post, Vissarion's heart bounded. As chairman, he would certainly be appointed chief economist at the next available opportunity, and he would be at the very fount and source of power, moving the president's own hand in exactly the direction in which the president wanted it to go. One point, however, worried Vissarion and left him in a terrible quandary. He felt he needed the help of someone with a level head and a keen intelligence, and he turned to me at once, as anyone in that situation naturally would. "George," he said, "to become the chairman of the CDR fulfills my greatest hopes and my wildest dreams. It is the open gateway to a glorious future of economic sycophancy, in which I may even outstrip that second purveyor of confirmation of all presidential guesses, the chief scientist of the United States."
"You mean the scientific advisor to the president?"
"If you want to be informal, yes. It needs only for me to become chairman of the CDR, and within 2 years I shall certainly be chief economist. Except," Except, I said. Vissarion seemed to take a firm grip on himself. I must go back to the beginning. The Club of Diminishing Returns was founded 62 years ago, and the name was chosen because the Law of Diminishing Returns is the one economic law that all economists, however well trained, have heard of. Its first president, a much beloved figure who predicted in November 1929 that the stock market was due for a serious downturn, was re-elected year after year and remained president for 32 years, dying at the patriarchal age of 96. Very commendable of him, I said. So many people give up far too soon when it only takes grit and determination to hang on till 96 or even beyond. Our second chairman did almost as well, holding the post for 16 years. He was the only one who did not become chief economist. He deserved it and was appointed to the post by Thomas E. Dewey the day before Election Day, but somehow... Our third chairman died after holding the post for 8 years, and our fourth died after being chairman for 4 years. Our late chairman, who just died last month, was the fifth in line, and he held the post for 2 years. Do you see something peculiar about all this, George? Peculiar? Did they all die natural deaths? Of course. Well, considering the post they held, that is peculiar. Nonsense, said Vissarion with some asperity. I call your attention to the lengths of time in office for successive chairmen. 32, 16, 8, 4, and 2. I thought for a while. The numbers seem to grow smaller. They don't just grow smaller. Each is exactly half of the previous number. Believe me, I had it checked by a physicist. You know, I think you're right. Has anyone else seen this? Certainly, said Vissarion. I have shown these figures to my fellow clubmen, and they all claim that it is not statistically significant unless the president issues an executive proclamation stating that it is. But don't you see the significance of this? If I accept the post as chairman, I will die after 1 year. That is certain. And if I do, it will be extremely difficult for the president to appoint me to the post of chief economist thereafter. I said, yes, Vissarion, you are in a dilemma. I have known many governmental functionaries who showed no signs of life behind the forehead, but not one who showed no signs of life at all. Give me a day to think of this, will you, Vissarion? We made arrangements to meet the next day. Same time, same place. It was an excellent restaurant after all, and unlike you, old man, Vissarion did not begrudge me a crust of bread. All right, then, he didn't begrudge me shrimp scampi, either. It was obviously a case for Azazel, and I felt thoroughly justified in putting my small 2-centimeter demon to work at this, with his otherworldly powers. After all, not only was Vissarion a kindly man with a good taste in restaurants, but I honestly felt he could do our nation great service in confirming the president's notions against the objections of people with better judgment. After all, who had elected them? Not that Azazel was glad to be called up. He no sooner saw me than he threw down the contents of his little hands. They were too small for me to make out very clearly, but they seemed to be little pasteboard rectangles of curious design.
There, he said,
his tiny face contorted and turning a rich yellow with rage. His small tail lashed wildly, and the miniature horns on his forehead fairly vibrated in the grip of his strong emotion.
Do you realize, you vile, huge mass of inferiority,
he shrilled,
that I finally held in my hand a Zachel, and not only a Zachel, but a Zachel with cumin high and pair of reels to boot. They were all bidding me up, and I couldn't lose. I would have cleaned up every half-blechki on the table.
I said severely, I don't know what you're talking about, but it does sound as though you have been gambling. Is that a refined and civilized thing to do? What would your poor mother say if she knew you were spending your time gambling with a group of bums? Azazel seemed taken aback. Then he mumbled,
You are right. My mothers would be broken-hearted, all three of them, especially my poor middle mother, who sacrificed so much for me.
And he broke into soprano howls that were quite dreadful to hear. There, there, I said soothingly.
I ached to stick my fingers in my ears, but that would have offended him. You can make it all well by helping a worthy being of this world. I told him the story of Vissarion Johnson. Said Azazel. What does that mean? I asked anxiously.
It means...
snapped Azazel. What else do you think it could possibly mean? Yes, but don't you think that all this is merely coincidence and that Vissarion ought to disregard it?
Possibly. Were it not that all this can't be coincidence and that Vissarion dare not disregard it, it has to be the working out of a law of nature.
How can it be a law of nature?
Do you think you know all the laws of nature?
Well, no.
Of course not. Our great poet, Chief Priest, wrote a delicate couplet on that once, which I will, with my own great poetic acumen, translate into your barbarous language.
Azazel cleared his throat, thought a moment, then said,
All nature is but art unknown to thee, all chance direction which thou canst not see.
I asked suspiciously, What does that mean?
It means that a law of nature is involved, and we must figure out what it is and how it might be taken advantage of to modify events to our liking. That's what it means. Do you think a great poet of my people would lie?
Well, can you do anything about it?
Possibly. There are a great many laws of nature, you know.
Are there?
Oh, yes. There's quite a cute little law of nature, devilishly attractive equation when put into wine balmy in tensors, that governs the heat of soup in relation to the hurry you are in to finish it. It's possible... If this odd diminution of duration of chairmanly term is governed by the law I think it is governed by, that I can so alter the nature of your friend's being as to insure him against damage from anything on earth. He won't be immune to the processes of physiological decay, of course. The workings of what I have in mind won't make him immortal, but it will, at least, make certain he won't die of infection or of accident, which I imagine he would find satisfactory.
Entirely so. But when will this come to pass?
I'm not completely sure. I'm rather busy these days with a young female of my species who seems uncannily smitten with me, poor soul.
He yawned, his small forked tongue curling into a helix and straightening again.
I seem to be short on sleep, but in 2 or 3 days it should be done.
Yes, but how can I tell when and if all is well?
That's easy, said Azazel. Just wait a few days and then shove your friend under a speeding truck. If he gets up unharmed, the modifications I have introduced will be working. And now, if you don't mind, I just want to play out this one hand, and then I will think of my poor mid-mother and leave the game. With my winnings, of course.
Don't think I didn't have plenty of trouble persuading Vissarion that he was perfectly safe. Nothing on earth can harm me, he kept saying. How do you know nothing on earth can harm me? I know. See here, Vissarion, I don't question your specialized knowledge. When you tell me that interest rates are going to fall, I don't quibble and ask you how you know. Well, that's all very well, but if I say interest rates are going to fall and then they proceed to rise, and they don't do that more than half the time... Merely your feelings are hurt. If, however, I act on the assumption that nothing on earth can hurt me, and then something on earth hurts me, I am a lot more than hurt. I am hurt. There's no arguing with logic, but I kept arguing anyway. I persuaded him, at least, to attempt no flat refusal of the post, but to try to delay them for a few days.
They'll never accept a delay, he said. But out of nowhere, it turned out that that very day was the anniversary of Black Friday, and the CDR went into the usual 3-day period of mourning and prayers for the dead.
The delay, therefore, came automatically, and that alone rather shook Vissarion into thinking that perhaps he did lead a charmed life. Then, at the end of the mourning period, when he ventured into public again, I was crossing a busy street with him, and I don't really remember how it happened,
I suddenly bent to tie a shoelace, and somehow I lost my balance and fell against him, and he lost his balance and fell into the line of traffic, and suddenly there was a devil of a shrieking of brakes and skidding of tires, and three cars were totaled. Vissarion didn't come out of it entirely untouched. His hair was rather mussed, his eyeglasses were slightly askew, and there was a spot of oil on the right knee of his trousers. He disregarded that, however. He said in awe, as he gazed at the carnage, "They never touched me. My goodness, they never touched me." And the very next day he was caught in the rain without rubbers, umbrella, or raincoat, a nasty cold rain, and did not catch cold on the spot. He called up, without even bothering to towel his hair, and accepted the post as chairman. He had a very nice tenure, I must say. He quintupled his fees at once, without any of this nonsense of achieving a better batting average, as his prognostications were concerned. After all, a client can't expect to have everything. If he gets unparalleled prestige in the professional man he consults, can he reasonably demand better advice also? Furthermore, he enjoyed life. No colds, nothing communicable at all. He crossed streets with impunity, disregarding the lights when he was in a hurry, and yet only rarely caused accidents to others. He had no hesitation about entering the park at night, and once, when a street hooligan placed a knife to his chest and suggested a transfer of funds, Vissarion simply kicked the young financier in the groin and walked on. The hooligan in question was so preoccupied with the kick that he entirely neglected to renew his application. It was on the anniversary of his succession to the chairmanship when I met him at the parkside. He was on his way to the testimonial luncheon for the occasion. It was a beautiful Indian summer day, and as we took our seats on the park bench, side by side, we felt completely happy and at ease. "George," he said, "I have had a happy year." "I'm delighted," I said. "My reputation is higher than that of any economist who ever lived. Only last month, when I warned that Amalgamated Suds would have to merge with Consolidated Soap, and they were forced to consolidate with Merged Soap, everyone marveled at how close I came." "I remember," I said. "And now, I want you to be the first to know..." "Yes, Vissarion?" "The President has asked me to be Chief Economist of the United States, and I have reached the pinnacle of all my dreams and desires. See here." He held out to me an impressive envelope with "White House" embossed in the upper left. I opened it, and as I did so, I heard a strange sort of zing, as though a bullet had buzzed its way past my ear, and I caught a strange flash of light in the corner of my eye. Vissarion was sprawled sideways on the bench, a splotch of blood on his shirt front, clearly dead. Some passers-by stopped in astonishment. Others screamed or gasped and hurried on. "Call a doctor," I called out. "Call the police." They came eventually, and the verdict was that he had been shot, right through the heart, by a gun of uncertain caliber, fired by some psychopathic sniper. They never caught the sniper, or even found the bullet. Fortunately, there were witnesses willing to testify that I had been holding a letter in my hand at the time, and was clearly innocent of any evil deed, or I might have had an uncomfortable time of it. Poor Vissarion. He had been chairman for exactly 1 year, as he himself had feared he would be, and yet it was not Azazel's fault. Azazel had said that Vissarion would not be killed by anything on earth, but, as Hamlet wisely said, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than there are in earth alone." Before the doctors and police arrived, I had noted the small hole in the wood of that part of the bench that had been behind Vissarion. With my penknife, I picked out the small, dark object embedded in it. It was still warm. Months later, I had it quietly looked at the museum, and I was right. It was a meteorite. In short, then, Vissarion had been killed by nothing on Earth. He was the first person in history known to have been killed by a meteorite. I kept it absolutely quiet, of course, for Vissarion was a very private man, and would have hated to achieve notoriety in this way. It would have drowned out all his great works of economics, and I couldn't allow that. But on every anniversary of his elevation and of his death, like today, I sit and think, "Poor Vissarion, poor Vissarion." George mopped at his eyes with his handkerchief, And I said, "And what happened to the next person to succeed to the chairmanship? He must have held office for a half year, and then the next one for 3 months, and then the next." George said, "There is no need to flaunt your knowledge of higher mathematics at me, old fellow. I'm not one of your poor, suffering readers. None of that ever happened. The irony of it is that the club altered the law of nature on its own."
"Oh, and how did they do that?"
"It struck them that the name of the club, the CDR, the Club of Diminishing Returns, was an ill-omened name that controlled the length of tenure of the chairman. They simply inverted the initials, therefore, and changed CDR to CRD.
And what does CRD stand for?"
"The Club of Random Distribution, of course," said George. "And the next chairman has now been in office for 10 years and is still going strong." And as the waiter returned with my change, George caught it in his handkerchief, put both handkerchief and bills into his breast pocket with a flourish, got up, and with a debonair wave of his hand, walked off. The Mind's Construction. I was moved to philosophic utterance that morning. Shaking my head in mournful reminiscence, I said, "There's no art to find the mind's construction in the face. He was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust." It was a rather chilly Sunday morning, and George and I were seated at a table in the local bagel nosh. George, I remember, was finishing his second large sesame bagel, this one liberally interspersed with cream cheese and whitefish. He said, "Is that something from a story of the type you habitually put together for the less discriminating editors?" "It happens to be Shakespeare," I said. "It's from Macbeth." "Ah, yes. I had forgotten your penchant for petty plagiarism." "It is not petty plagiarism to express yourself in an appropriate quotation. What I was saying was that I had a friend whom I had considered a man of consideration and taste. I had bought him dinners. I had on occasion lent him money. I had praised his appearance and character fulsomely. And, mind you, I did this entirely without any consideration for the fact that he was a book reviewer by profession, if you want to call it a profession." George said, "And despite all these disinterested actions of yours, the time came when your friend reviewed one of your books and he proceeded to slam it unmercifully?" "Oh," I said, "did you read the review?" "Not at all. I just asked myself what kind of review a book of yours could possibly get, and the correct answer came to me in a flash." I didn't mind his saying it was a bad book, mind you, George. At least, I didn't mind it any more than any other writer would mind such a brainless statement. But when he went on to use phrases like senile dementia, I felt that was going too far. Saying that the book was meant for 8-year-olds, but that they would be better off playing tiddlywinks, was hitting below the belt. I sighed and repeated, "There's no art..." "You said that already," said George at once. He seemed so pleasant, so friendly, so grateful for little favors. How could I know that underneath it all he was a vicious, libelous hellhound? George said, "But he was a critic. How could he be anything else? You trained for the post by maligning your mother. It is really unbelievable that you should have been fooled in so ridiculous a fashion. You are worse than my friend Van Devanter Robinson ever was, and he, I'll have you know, was once spoken of as a possible candidate for a Nobel Prize for naivete. His story is a curious one." "Please," I said. "The review came out in the current New York Review of Books. 5 columns of bitter spleen, venom, and gall. I am in no mood to listen to one of your stories." "I thought you would be," said George, "and you are perfectly right. It will take your mind off your own inconsequential troubles. My friend Van Devanter Robinson was a young man whom anyone would have judged to be of great promise. He was handsome, cultured, intelligent, and creative. He had been to the best schools, and he was in love with a delightful young creature, Minerva Schlump. Minerva was one of my goddaughters and was devoted to me, as was only right. A person of my moral fiber, of course, is quite averse to allowing young ladies of outstanding proportions to hug one and attempt to climb into one's lap. But there was something so endearing about Minerva, so innocently childlike, and most of all so resilient to the touch, that I allowed it in her case.
Naturally, I never allowed it in the presence of Van Devanter, who was quite unreasonable in his jealousy. He explained this failing of his once in accents that touched my heart. "George," he said, "from childhood it was my ambition to fall in love with a young woman of superlative virtue, of untouched purity, of, if I may use the expression, a porcelain-like gleam of innocence. In Minerva Schlump, if I may be allowed to breathe that divine name, I had found just such a woman. It is the one case in which I know I cannot be deceived. Were I ever to find out my trust was abused, I would scarcely know how to continue to live. I would become an embittered old man with no consolation but such paltry items as my mansion, my servants, my club, and my inherited wealth." Poor fellow! He was not deceived in young Minerva, as I well knew, for when she wriggled delightedly on my lap, I could easily tell her utter lack of any trace of vice. But it was the only person or thing or concept in which he was not deceived. The poor young man simply had no judgment. He was, though it may seem unkind to say so, as stupid as you are. He lacked the art to find the mind's... Yes, I know you said that already. Yes, yes, you said it twice. What made it particularly hard for him, of course, was that Van Devanter was a rookie detective on the New York police force. It had been his life's ambition, in addition to finding the perfect damosel, to be a detective. To be one of the keen-eyed, hawk-nosed gentlemen who are the terrors of evildoers everywhere. With that end in mind, he majored in criminology at both Groton and Harvard, and read assiduously those important research reports committed to paper by authorities such as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Dame Agatha Christie. All that, together with the unremitting use of family influence, and the fact that an uncle of his was borough president of Queens at the time, led to his appointment to the force. Sadly, and quite unexpectedly, he was not a success at this. Unsurpassed at the ability to weave an inexorable chain of logic while sitting in his armchair, making use of evidence gathered by others, he found himself utterly incapable of gathering the evidence himself. His problem was that he had this incredible urge to believe whatever someone told him. Any alibi, however sieve-like, baffled him. Any well-known perjurer had but to offer his word of honor, and Van Devanter found himself incapable of doubting him. This became so notorious that criminals from the lowliest purse snatcher to the highest politician and industrialist refused to be questioned by anyone else. "Bring us Van Devanter," they would cry out. "I will spill my guts to him," the purse snatcher would say. "I will apprise him of the facts as carefully arranged in the proper order by none other than myself," the politician would say. "I will explain that the $100 million government check just happened to be lying about in the petty cash drawer, and I needed a tip for the shoeshine boy," said the industrialist. The result was that whatever he touched got away. He had an exonerative thumb, an expression invented for the occasion by a literary friend of mine. Of course you don't remember inventing it. I'm not referring to you. Would I be so mad as to think of you as literary? As the months passed, the caseload in the courts grew less, and innumerable grieving burglars, muggers, and assorted felons were restored to their friends and relations without a stain on their reputations. Naturally, it did not take long for New York's finest to understand the situation and to penetrate the cause. Van Devanter had been on the job not more than 2.5 years when it dawned on him that the camaraderie he had been accustomed to was fading, and that his superiors were wont to greet him with a puzzled frown. There was virtually no talk of promotion, even though Van Devanter would mention his borough president uncle at what seemed like appropriate moments. He came to me, as young men in trouble are wont to do, seeking refuge in the wisdom of a man of the world. "I don't know what you mean, old man, by asking me if I knew of anyone I could recommend. Please don't distract me with non sequiturs." "Uncle George," he said, "I believe I am in a spot of difficulty." He always addressed me as Uncle George, impressed as he was by the dignity and splendid nobility lent me by my well-kept white locks, so different in nature from your own dubiously unkempt mutton chops. "Uncle George," he said, "there seems to be an unaccountable reluctance to promote me. I remain a rookie detective, zero class. My office is right in the middle of the corridor, and my key to the lavatory doesn't work. I don't mind this in itself, you understand, But my dear Minerva, in her unspoiled artlessness, has suggested that this may mean I am a failure, and her little heart almost breaks at the thought. I don't want to marry a failure, she says, her little lips pouting. People will laugh at me.
I said, Is there any reason why you should be having this trouble, Van Devanter, my boy? I asked.
None at all. It's a complete mystery to me. I admit I haven't solved any cases, but I don't think that's the problem. No one can be expected to solve them all, you know.
Do any of the other detectives solve at least a few? I asked.
Yes, they do, now and then. But their manner of doing so shocks me to the core. They have an unlovely sense of disbelief, a most deplorable skepticism, a distasteful way of staring at some accused person in a supercilious manner and saying, Oh, yeah, or says you. It just humiliates them. It just isn't the American way.
Is it possible the accused might be telling lies and that they should be treated with skepticism? Van Devanter puzzled over that for a moment.
Why, I believe that might be so. What a horrible thought.
Well, I said, let me think about this. That evening I called up Azazel, the 2-centimeter demon who, on an occasion or two, has been of use to me with his mysterious powers. I don't know if I've ever mentioned him to you, but... Oh, I have I? Well, he appeared on the little ivory circle on my desk, about which I burn the special incense and recite the age-old incantations. The details, however, are secret. When he appeared, he was wearing a long, flowing garment, or at least it seemed long and flowing in comparison to the 2 centimeters that measured him from the base of his tail to the tips of his horns. He had one of his arms raised high, and he was speaking in his shrill way while his tail twitched from side to side. Clearly, he was in the midst of something or other. He is a creature who is somehow preoccupied with unimportant detail. I never seem to get him when he is quietly at rest or in dignified repose. He is always engaged in some petty concern of no moment and is furious at having me interrupt him. On this occasion, however, he became aware of me and at once lowered his arm and smiled. At least, I think he smiled, for it is hard to see the details of his face. And once, when I used a hand lens to help me make them out, he seemed unaccountably offended. He said,
It's just as well. I welcome the change. I have the speech well in hand, and I'm certain of success.
Success at what, O Great One? Though success in anything you do is certain. He seems to have a fondness for this sort of orotundity. He resembles you oddly in this respect.
I am running for political office, he said with satisfaction. I expect to be elected Grod Catcher.
May I ask humbly that you relieve my ignorance by informing me of what a grod might be?
Why, a grod is a small domestic animal much esteemed as a pet by my people. Some of these animals lack a license, and a grod catcher is expected to gather them up. They are small creatures of fiendish cunning and resolute defiance, and it takes someone of might and intelligence to succeed at the task. There are people who sneer and say, Azazel couldn't be elected grod catcher. But I intend to show them I can. Now, what can I do for you?
I explained the situation, and Azazel seemed surprised.
Do you mean to say that on your miserable world, it is not possible for people to tell when other people make statements that do not coincide with objective truth?
We have a device called a lie detector, I said. It measures blood pressure, electrical conductivity of the skin, and so on. It can detect lies, although it also detects nervousness and tension and calls them lies as well.
Naturally. But there are subtle glandular functions that exist in any species intelligent enough to misrepresent truth. Or is this something you wouldn't know?
I avoided answering that question. Is there any way to make it possible for zero-grade Detective Robinson to detect that glandular function?
Without one of your crude machines? Using the functioning of his own mind?
Yes.
You must realize you are asking me to deal with one of the minds of your species. Large, but infinitely crude.
I realize that.
Well, I shall try. You will have to take me to him, or bring him to me,
and in either case allow me to study him.
Certainly. And it was done.